Feeding the Flame by Tuesday Love Saint Grandpa, read for you by Blue Friend in beautiful BC. Chapter 7. Injure Others and You Injure Yourself. The day had been very pleasant, a clear blue sky and warmer temperature than had been during the past few weeks. There were signs that the winter had ended and that spring was really thinking about peeping round the corner of the calendar and bringing warmth and sunshine and new life to those jaded and defeated by the frigid winters of Canada. In the valleys, snow was still thick and would remain so for perhaps a few more weeks. But in the higher ground, exposed to the warming rays of the sun, the snows were fast melting, and trickling riverlets came rushing down to swell the St. John River. The day had seen many birds flying by, signs that spring was coming, birds returning to their old haunts. A whole covey of ducks went by. Soon after, a huge black back seagull had come sweeping in from the sea to land on the roof and to peer about and utter raucous cries. The evening had turned chilly. There was a hint of snow in the air. Suddenly, unexpectedly, there came the drumming of hailstones beating rapidly upon the windows, bouncing off the balconies, and for a few moments carpeting the road with a white icy sheen. The old man thought, "Oh, poor Mr. Robichaud, he'll have to get busy again in the morning." During the day, Mr. Robichaud had been very busy sweeping aside puzzles of melting snow, brushing away gravel thrown down by city trucks in an attempt to provide traction for motor traffic. But now the hail had come driving fresh gravel into the front of the building and adding to the work of an already much overworked man. The evening sped by, and lights in the city went out one by one. In the hospital, the lights were ever on, always ready for emergencies, always ready by day and by night. The old man turned his head and looked out of the window over the balcony. Down in the harbor, there was still activity. The Russian ship, loading grain for Russia, was still a blaze of light. There was a clank of machinery and the hissing of high-pressure steam. Closer, there was the terrible blare, and blare, and blare again, as one of the Canadian National Infernal Diesel engines clattered along the rails over the level crossing, hooting and blaring as if the world had gone mad. I wonder that no one has told the engineer that there are signal lights on the crossing, thought the old man, because it does seem insane how in Canada locomotives go along to the constant blare of the sirens and the incessant clanging of bells. It's something like a gang of very small children playing with toys in the noisiest way possible. Canada, even more than the USA, should be known as the land of noise and bustle. The old man lifted his gaze again beyond the level crossing and the endless procession of freight cars obstructing the road. In the harbor, tugs were coming to a Liberian ship which had just recently unloaded 7,000 tons of nickel ore. Earlier, the ship had been arrested for non-payment of dues in the USA. It had steamed away from a Pacific coast port, apparently without the little formality of paying harbor dues. But the telephone was much faster than the ship, and telephone messages had raced all across the Pacific coast of the USA to the east coast of Canada, and earlier in the day, police officials had marched aboard the ship and served an arrest order to the captain. Frantic work had resulted in a bond being posted, and now the ship was free to move. So, tugs were coming to tow her out sternwards, tow her out backwards into the deep water channel, and then, with her pointing in the right direction, off she would steam, possibly for Australia. The pilot was already aboard. The pilot boat was going out beyond the buoys, waiting for the ship, which would then slow, and the pilot boat would sidle along and take off the pilot, and then the ship would be free to move away on her own. The ship went out silently, no hooting, no clanking, no hissing of steam. The ship stole away as if she were ashamed of being arrested through the perfidy and bad faith of mankind. Mankind, as exemplified by those who should have paid the bills incurred for their service. All over the city, the sleeping people were leaving their physical bodies and going up into the astral worlds. Their silver cords were stretched out like skins of silk, self-illuminated, shining, twitching, and jerking. The old man smiled to himself because from one room came the soft snores of Buttercup. "She'd never believe what a racket she's making," thought the old man. Suddenly her astral form appeared through a wall, and off she shot, straight up and then away in the direction of the USA. With her astral out of her body, the snores increased. From another room, Rab was doing a bit of snoring, too. She'd gone off earlier to an astral cat land, where she would be met by some truly beloved little people. Miss Cooey, Mrs. Fifi Greywhiskers, Miss Cindy, Long Tom, and Lord Furhead, and others. Rab had the benefit that she was aware of when she was going to the land of the astral cats, but probably Rab was not aware of how stertorous her snores would be. Little girl cat, Cleopatra, was sleeping away as well, beside Rab. She too was off to the land of the astral cats, but Fat Cat, Taddykins, was on duty. She would be on duty until 4 o'clock in the morning, and Fat Cat Taddykins was resting on the shelf just above the radiator, where she got all the warmth, all the beautifully heated rising air. One arm was dangling over, and the other was supporting her chin. Her hindquarters were facing one way, and her headquarters were facing another way, a position that only a cat could adopt. Far out in the Bay of Fundy, a fishing boat suddenly flashed its searchlight. It wavered around for a moment, and then as suddenly was extinguished, and there was no trace that a little fishing vessel was anywhere about. Yet, all over the bay, there were fishing vessels with their lines out and with their nets, hoping to get fish, and that were not contaminated by the mercury in the water flowing from the USA, from some big industrial plant in the USA, which had discharged much poisonous effluvia into the streams passing by their boundaries. And yet there was a fresh source of poison, because an oil tanker had broken up and sunk beneath the waves off the coast of Nova Scotia, and oil and poisoned birds and fish were being swept shorewards all the time. So the fishermen of New Brunswick were out about their business rather gloomily, knowing that their livelihood was at stake because of the criminal manner in which man polluted the sources of nature. The sky had a few clouds scudding across. There seemed to be quite a wind coming up. The three flags away on the hill were flapping madly, and the halyards were slapping against the masts, as if in unison with the waving of the flags. Over the hill, beyond Misbeck, the full moon suddenly sailed with amazing rapidity straight up into a clear patch of sky, casting a pale brilliance over the whole scene, dimming the street lights, dimming the lights along the new bridge over the St. John River, and as the moon rose, the shaft of silver light sped rippling along the sea all the way from Misbeck Point to the harbor. Brilliant fingers touching a fishing vessel here, lighting a buoy there, silvering a strip of land and breaking up in ripples as it encountered the wake of a speeding tug. The old man turned suddenly, and a sharp, tearing, wrenching pain gripped him inside, a pain that left him gasping and almost retching with the sudden agony of it. Pain, his constant companion for a long time past. Pain, which was becoming even more frequent and even more intense. Pain, which pointed with inexorable fingers at the calendar, showing how the journey through life was progressing, showing how soon it must end. On the shelf above the radiator, Fat Cat Tattykins stood up, peered intently at the old man, muttered to herself, and went trotting into where Rab was still sleeping. Soon the silver cord attached between Rab's astral and physical quivered and started to reel in. It reeled in with increasing rapidity until the astral body came as well. Seconds after, Rab came in to see what could be done for the old man. But what could be done? The old man had been in a state of permanent amazement since having medical treatment in Canada. In his ignorance, he had thought that the first duty of a doctor was the relief of suffering. That is what he had been taught. He'd been taught that first of all you relieve the suffering and then you try to cure what caused it. But now, well, he saw the other side of the story, not as the doctor, but as the patient. The old man had had much pain, and he and Rab had asked the doctors for some pain-relieving tablets or anything. First, they'd been told, "No, we don't want to give it yet. It might disguise the symptoms." But in the meantime, the old man still had his pain, still had his suffering. In the meantime, the old man had been taken to hospital as a desperate emergency, and a compassionate nurse at the first hospital had done what the doctors did not seem able to do. Then came the second emergency in another hospital, and the verdict that nothing could be done. So knowing that nothing could be done to cure, the old man and Rab and Buttercup could just not understand why it was that nothing could be done to relieve suffering, to ease the pain, to give rest for. To ask yet again, is not the doctor's first task the relief of suffering? And if he cannot cure the cause, then surely he can give relief while there's still life? So Rab looked around helplessly. What was there that she could do? There wasn't anything. She had no drugs, nothing. So once again, she just had to sit and watch and give nothing else except sympathy and understanding. Soon there came Cleopatra, who did the feline equivalent of handsprings in the hope of distracting attention from pain, in the hope of providing some late relief, and Cleopatra and Tattykins both purred away to show how they understood how bad all this suffering was. Two little people, who to the average man or woman in the street would appear to be just two very, very beautiful little animals, but to those who knew them, these two little people are people apart, intelligent, highly civilized, and entirely sympathetic and understanding. And so the old man, lying in his bed of pain, still wondered why the local medical fraternity did not seem to have heard of pain relievers, or, if they had, why did they not use them? Why did they not use such methods of giving relief to one who truly was in considerable distress? Now the sky darkened, the moon was extinguished by black lowering clouds, a sudden haze came over the far sea and sped rapidly landwards. The first pattering drops of rain hit the window panes and a blast of air shook the building. Soon the storm burst in all its fury, the howling, shrieking wind, and torrents of rain interspersed with hail. Down it came, drowning out all memory of a pleasant day, hiding the harbor under a veil of rain. Lights in the streets showed up a ghostly greenish-blue as the sodium lamps vainly strove to penetrate the water fog and the beating rain. The drumming of the rain was monotonous, the shrieking of the wind howling round the corners of the building, pushing against the windows, making the doors rattle. It reminded the old man of how things seemed to be inside him. The night seemed endless. It seemed that every minute was an hour, and every hour was a day. Rab, at the old man's request, went back to bed. Cleo stayed for a time, and then she, too, went back to bed. Tattykins resumed her post on the shelf until 4 o'clock in the dark and gloomy morning. At 4 o'clock, Miss Cleopatra came back into the room and jumped up by Tatty. Briefly, they touched noses, and Tatty jumped off, leaving Miss Cleopatra to settle down into almost the same position that Tatty had adopted. Outside, the first traffic was beginning to move, early workers going to the docks. Down below, a man started his car. Perhaps he was going to the dry dock to see what was happening. A lonely tug hooted away as if lost in the rain and darkness. There was no sign of the lighthouse. The rain completely obscured its rays, but faintly could be heard the mournful lowing of the foghorn. The hours dragged on. At last, dim gray light peered over the Mispeck hills, a dim gray light which did little to dispel the gloom, for it just showed a thoroughly unpleasant day, everything saturated with water. Water teeming from the rooftops, water streaming down the roadways, and suddenly squalls obliterating the sight of the bridge and the harbor. More hours passed, and more people began to stir. Rab came back. Shortly after, Buttercup came. Another day had started. The harbor looked almost empty. A Blue Star freighter was just turning into the stream, ready to go out. She, too, was anxious to leave us. The Russian ship was still there, with a faint plume of steam coming from its exhaust, and down on the DOT wharf, men were boarding one of the red-hulled ships that went out to take supplies to the lighthouse keepers and provide service to the light boys and the sound boys. In the middle of the harbor, a solitary tug was motionless. A figure at the stern seemed to be hauling in on a fishing line. Perhaps the tugmen were trying to catch their breakfast. The inevitable, incessant mail came pouring in. On this day, with the old man feeling something like the cat brought in, 78 letters arrived, nearly all of them from people who wanted something. Nearly all of them without the elementary courtesy of a reply stamp. One woman wrote so gushingly, "Oh, Dr. Rampa, I've been told that you're going to die, and I thought I must get your help before it's too late for me. Will you do this for me? You must do this for me before you die." People wrote in and wrote in. The old man did his best to answer reasonable questions. Buttercup worked hard and accurately, typing the letters which the old man was now no longer able to do. But there was no let-up from people. So many of them. No sooner had they received a reply than they sent back a whole shoal of questions, as they said, before it was too late. One lady in Toronto sent 7 letters all by one delivery. Apparently, she wrote a letter of several pages, and then, when she'd gotten it all ready and posted it, she thought of other things she wanted to know. And so on, until 7 letters had arrived. The old man had many strange experiences with letters. One woman in Ontario wrote really inflammatory letters and managed to get hold of the old man's address. She got in touch with the police and said it was desperately necessary to contact Dr. Rampa. It was a matter of life and death. And so our good-natured, well-intentioned local police sent a police car to where the old man lived, to where the old man was ill, and the policeman had a very stern order. "You must phone this number immediately. It's a matter of life and death." The same woman sent special delivery letters and telegrams, everything. And at last, the old man couldn't handle that any longer. "At last" was caused by a letter from the woman saying that unless the old man would be her friend, she would commit suicide. And she enclosed 3 pages with just the same thing repeated. "Die," and her name. "Die," and her name. "Die," and her name. The old man could take no more, so he got in touch with the police in the district in which she lived, and the police went along to see her about these letters of an amorous nature. Now, from that quarter, at least, there has been peace. It is understood, though, that the poor, unfortunate policeman who had to call upon her returned to the station considerably shaken by the experience. When the old man was at Habitat, he was in bed one night quite seriously ill. At around midnight, there came a thunderous knocking at the door. Rab hurried from her room, and the old man managed to get out of bed and into the wheelchair, and to grasp something in case it was an unwanted intruder. But at the door were two French-Canadian policemen, and in decidedly shaky English, they demanded to see Dr. Rampa. One of the policemen was from the fraud squad, and the other was a police driver. They wanted to know all sorts of things. All manner of questions had to be answered, and at midnight. At last, the old man wanted to know what this was all about. Why were they asking so many questions? And the two policemen looked at each other, and one walked to the telephone, then in a gabble of French-Canadian, spoke to his superintendent. After replacing the telephone, their manner changed completely. He said that a man in the Middle West states of the USA had telephoned to Montreal police headquarters, saying there was a desperate emergency, and would the police please contact Dr. Rampa, address unknown, and get him to call a certain number in that Middle West American state. In relaying the message to the police on patrol, the information was somewhat garbled, and because a fraud squad man took the message, he thought he was coming to see the old man on a matter of fraud, and so he acted accordingly. However, at last, matters were straightened out and the police left. Apologies were a little bit late, well after midnight, and after rousing and distressing a very sick old man. The same thing happened when the old man lived in St. John previously. The police were phoned by some old biddy in Montreal. She said it was a matter of life and death, and so the police came up like eager beavers, thinking they were going to save a life. The phone call was made, and the stupid clot of a woman just wanted the old man to tell her husband that she shouldn't have any sex life with him. Incidentally, although considerable expense was involved, the woman and her husband have not made any attempt to repay that expense. That's what usually happens. Some person just thinks that the old man is made of money and that he is just dying to rush to their aid and to pay them for that pleasure. Quite recently, a man wrote from Asia. He wrote to say that he wanted to do good for mankind, and he thought he would become a doctor. So he instructed the old man to send money immediately, for this would be doctor's first-class airfare to Canada. He told the old man that he, the old man, should have the honor of providing board and lodging and pay all expenses for this would-be doctor. He ended by writing, "I can never repay you, but at least you will know that I am doing good for others." Yet another case at Habitat was when a man came late at night, complete with his luggage. He just came to the door and banged until he got an answer. He came all the way from India, and he said, "I have come to live with you as your son. I will cook for you." And he tried to push his way in, complete with luggage. The old man was thinking about these things, thinking about some of the humans who wrote in, thinking of the woman who wrote to say that her book was all ready, the book which the old man had dictated to her telepathically, and now she wanted a letter written by him saying that a publisher was to take it and give her the royalties. A most entertaining book could be written about some of the remarkable letters which are sent. But really, the old man, in the short time remaining, is far more interested in answering questions which it is hoped will help people. So many questions are quite sensible. Questions such as this: why is it that we never remember the tasks we are supposed to do when we are on this earth? Why do we have to press forward blindly without knowing what we're doing? Can you tell me that? Well, yes, certainly, there's nothing very remarkable about it. If people knew beforehand what they had to do, they would concentrate exclusively on that thing, and so gain a very one-sided knowledge or experience. I am often told that I liken the earth life to a school, but of course I do. It is a school for humans, and so going back to our school explanation, consider this. You study at school, and then you have to take an examination. You have to take an examination, yes, an examination to find out how much you know. You go to the examination room without knowing what the questions are going to be. If you knew the questions before you went to the examination room, then it would just not be an examination at all, because you would just swat up a few sentences on a very few subjects, and obviously you would pass the examination with ease, but you wouldn't know anything. At school, one has to learn a broad field of knowledge, and to make sure that one does learn an adequately broad field of knowledge, examinations are set for some future date. The students know that there's going to be an examination, but obviously they don't know the exact questions. Thus, it is by the examinations and not specialize in just one or two items. Supposing a surgeon, or rather surgeon-to-be, was taking his examinations, and he had been slack throughout his studies. Supposing that someone had told him the precise nature of the questions. If the surgeon-to-be was unscrupulous and unprincipled, he would concentrate only on the answers to those questions, and of course he would pass with flying colors. But you might be his first patient. Supposing you went for a kidney operation and all he could do was remove an appendix, would you feel happy? Would you feel happy in dealing or flying with an air pilot who, by knowing the answers to the exact examination questions and knowing little else, had managed to get a job? Of course you wouldn't. You are kept from knowing what your task is in this life, so that you do your best, or at least it's hoped that you will, in the whole field of life. You might have a task that you have to be kind to cats. Well, if you knew what you had to do, you might be very kind to cats. Sickeningly so, in fact. But you might be so wrapped up in the cat theme that you would perhaps unwittingly cause anguish to dogs or horses by completely and utterly neglecting them. No, Mrs. Questioner, it is providential that humans do not know their task on earth. If they did, it would make them unbalanced and one-sided. But do not get the idea that everyone who writes is a dummkopf or a clutterhead. Such would be absolutely incorrect. I have become acquainted with some extraordinarily nice people. Valerie Sorok, for one. She was the first to greet me when we arrived from Ireland. Since that, we have been firm friends, and Valerie Sorok has an absolutely wonderful virtue. She is completely and utterly reliable. I am not at all mobile, and if there is anything in particular that I need, of course, always something which is extremely difficult to obtain, then Valerie Sorok is the one to locate it. We live quite a long way apart physically, but we're very close spiritually. Let me salute Valerie Sorok here for her unfailing constancy, for her loyalty, and for her immense effort she puts in to do any kindness. She's not a wealthy woman by any means at all. In fact, she has to work hard and travel many miles to earn what is truly a mere pittance. Yet, Valerie Sorok can always afford the time to do anything and to help. So, Valerie, my thanks to you and my undying friendship to you in return for the friendship you have always given me. There are quite a number of people who are definitely above average, very definitely above average. And it's a sad thought that these people most times are not at all well endowed with this world's goods. Most times these people are so decent and so modest that they definitely underrate their own abilities. I'm thinking now of two very brilliant people, Mr. and Mrs. Cermak. They are having a difficult time because, in my opinion, they do not sell themselves. Mr. Cermak is a man whom anyone could be proud to know, a man of the better type, a man with first-class brain, and who excels at something which always defeats me, figures. Figures that go 1, 2, 3, etc., not the type that one looks at, although I have no doubt that Mr. Cermak could possibly beat me at looking at those. Then there is Mrs. Cermak, a truly very, very gifted person indeed. She has most extraordinary artistic ability. Ceramics, photography, anything in the artistic line seems to be child's play to her. She puts the brakes on her own progress, though, by tending to be too much of a perfectionist. One cannot have perfection in this world, and if one strives too much for utter perfection, then one wastes too much time on the unattainable. Soon we shall be dealing with two questions, one from Mr. Cermak and one from Mrs. Cermak. Yes, people write to me with all sorts of strange problems, and the longest letter I've received from any one person was written on a piece of paper 9 inches wide by 13 feet and 9 inches long. It was all one continuous sheet of paper, and the whole thing was closely typed. So as I say, that is the longest letter I've ever had. What would you do with it? Well, so did I. Then, of course, there's John Henderson. I became acquainted with him following a letter or two that he wrote to me. John Henderson is a very nice fellow, very capable, and he's going places. It's my hope that later he will be able to unfold his spiritual wings and write a book or two, start a spiritual retreat, and do whatever people on the other side suggest that he should do. Yes, I make some very nice acquaintanceships. Some people who write in haven't the vaguest interest in metaphysics. But what does it matter? What does it matter? if one is interested in metaphysics or not. In fact, it might be a good idea now to answer a question from Mr. Hans Cermak. He says, "Yes, I do have a question, Dr. Rampa. What is the most important thing a person should or can do to develop any latent occult abilities he or she might possess? I'm asking this because I seem to have trouble getting started with the things you describe so clearly in your books. Obviously, I'm doing something wrong, and I'm wondering whether there isn't a way of preparing one's mind and body." Actually, it doesn't matter if you do astral travel or not, consciously. That is, because everyone does astral travel in the time of sleep. But if you find difficulty in doing something, then are you sure, really sure, that you want to do it? Are you sure that there is not some bar imposed, let us say, by difficulties in a past life? Supposing a person, oh, not you, of course, had been a witch in a past life. Supposing you'd been burned at the stake or bumped off in some equally interesting way. Then if you came back to this life with more or less of an interest in occultism, you might have some ingrained fear that if you started again, you'd end up at the stake or at the end of a rope, and so your subconscious would clap the brakes on you and you would make no progress. The only way one can proceed, if one finds real difficulty in settling down to occult work, is meditate on the problem. Do you really, sincerely desire to astral travel, or to do clairvoyance, or read the cards, or do anything in that field? If you do, if you can say yes, then ask yourself why you want to do it. You must clear up all these problems first. The next thing to ask yourself is, do you fear that you will be out of body and not be able to get back? Are you afraid that some strange entities would attack you if you get out of the body? If so, remember, no harm whatsoever, no harm of any sort can happen to you if you are not afraid. If you are sure that you really want to do occult work, then the best thing is to devote a certain time each day, even half an hour of an evening, to thinking about it. And the best way is to imagine as strongly as possible that you are doing what you want to do, because when you can get over to your subconscious that you want to get out into the astral, he will, metaphorically, unlock the gate and set you free. Think of the subconscious as a sort of idiot, a high-grade idiot, if you like, but who obeys orders quite literally, so that if at some time in the past you've said, "Gee, for Pete's sake, don't let me get out of the body," then the subconscious will obey that injunction until you can overpower its one-track mind and replace the obsolete order by another. But remember that if you think you are not making progress, you definitely are, so long as you are aware of things. And my strong advice to you is that if you are experiencing obstacles or difficulties, then just do not bother. Wait until things settle themselves. When I was studying Morse code many years ago, I was warned about the hump. Well, this mysterious hump bothered me until I reached a speed of 23 words a minute, and no matter how much I tried, no matter how many hours of practice I put in, I could not get over that hump. It proved to be a mountain in the way of my progress towards a faster Morse sending and receiving speed. One day, I uttered some really naughty words with fervor. I said, in effect, "Oh well, if I can't go any faster, I just can't." Later in the day, I sat down at the old Morse key again and found that I could go much faster. In fact, I could do nearly 30 words a minute. I had got over the hump. I'd been trying too hard, and I think probably you are trying too hard too, Mr. Cermak. And you are also trying too hard. If you are meeting obstacles, don't go on like a bulldozer. Take it easy. Think about things, and you'll find that the path of least resistance has enabled you to get over the hump, and you'll be surprised at the result. Well, I think that in the interests of domestic harmony, I should reply to a question from Mrs. Cermak in this same chapter as that in which I replied to a question from her husband. Otherwise, I could be accused of separating husband and wife or something like that. Here is what Mrs. Cermak writes. A question. Well, by the time it's too late to submit them, I know I will be full of them. Right now, there is only one problem that is still very much with me, and maybe other people might profit too, if you would be kind enough to say a few words on this topic. It's time, or rather shortage of time. There are only so many hours in the day, and they're just not sufficient to do all the things I want to do. I surely don't shirk work, but what is the most frustrating is that not only is there not enough time for all the more or less mundane things one wants to do, but there never seems to be enough time left for the spiritual things one wants to learn. If it's meditation, I don't seem to have enough energy to get up extra early either on Saturday or Sunday. Instead of sleeping an hour later, and if it's astral travel, I seem to fall asleep as soon as I hit the pillow. All of this relates to time management. Time and motion. Everyone has three or four times as much time as they think they have, but usually people waste time in much the same way as people waste water. And so there is a shortage of water throughout the world. Drinking water, that is. Time and motion experts study how people do things. Just as an example, if you go to the kitchen, how many things do you bring back with you at one time? Do you bring back one or two things when you know perfectly well that right after you'll have to go back for two or three things more? If people will only make an intelligent appraisal of things they have to do, then they will have adequate time in which to do it. The best way to proceed is to write down on a sheet of paper all the things you want to do on a given day. Toss out the things which are not really necessary and plan the remaining things so that you go the shortest way about them and do not have to make two or three journeys when one will suffice. Some people have shopping to do, so they dash around to the corner store and they get one thing. And then they return to the kitchen and find they're short of salt or sugar or something else, and so they go back again. They are running about all the time. Others, perhaps, have letters to mail, and they make a special journey to mail those letters, whereas, if they only waited a little longer, they could mail the letters when they went shopping. One can divide up the day, just the same as at school lessons were divided up. So long for geography, so long for history, so long for arithmetic, so long for recreation, and so long for meals. If people only set about their tasks in a sensible manner, they would have ample time in which to do things. In Mrs. Cermak's case, she has a highly intelligent husband who would gladly assist her in planning her days, a task which he is well fitted to undertake very successfully. So the answer is, if people would plan their days properly and stick to the plan, there would be adequate time for everything. This is the voice of experience, because I practice what I preach successfully. End of chapter 7.